It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Professor Fabrizio Michelassi to our first Grand Rounds in 2007. Dr. Michelassi graduated summa cum laude from the University of Pisa Medical School, and then he transitioned to the New World, where he trained at New York University, followed by a research fellowship at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Michelassi then left New York in 1984 and became vice chair of surgery at the University of Chicago. He returned to New York just a few years ago and became the Lewis Adderby Stimson Professor of Surgery and chairman of surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. Dr. Michelassi has published over 100 peer-reviewed articles, more than 35 book chapters, as well as 7 instructional movies for surgeons. And he is also an editor on a book of surgical treatment of inflammatory bowel disease. And you'd expect some old tottering man to come up and give us the grand rounds, but I think he's been on the Mediterranean diet so long, he looks quite young. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Michelassi. Thank you.
Dr. Jackson, I thank you very much for your introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the medical staff for the invitation to give Grand Rounds, the first one in 2007. It is a pleasure to be here at the Methodist Hospital. For the past 2 years, we have had closer relationship with the hospital, and certainly in my case, with the Department of Surgery and with Dr. Barbara Bass. And so this is my third visit to TMH. I can tell you that I'm very pleased to be here. I've met with the faculty members of the Department of Surgery and whoever I could meet, and I'm really pleased for the possibilities that we have for collaboration and for future development. I was asked to talk about Crohn's disease. As I'm a general surgeon, so I'm not a colorectal surgeon. I also do GI oncology, but there is no question that I spend a lot of time dealing with patients with Crohn's disease. And just for historical purposes, let me just start by saying that the first description in the literature about Crohn's disease is probably back in 1913 by a Scottish physician by the name of Deal, who published in 1913 on the British Medical Journal a paper entitled Crohn's Interstitial Enteritis. By now, we all know that this disease goes under the name of Crohn's, and because Dr. Burl Crohn, together with Dr. Leon Ginsberg and Oppenheimer, published a paper in JAMA in 1932 entitled Regional Ileitis. You can see here, let's see if I can, that's not good. Oh, here it is. This is Dr. Crohn. He was a gastroenterologist in Mount Sinai in New York City. Dr. Oppenheimer, pathologist also in Mount Sinai in New York City, and Dr. Ginsberg, the surgeon who operated on most of those patients. Dr. Crohn, I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Crohn. I was a resident at New York University, NYU, between 1977 and 1984. And so just before his death in 1983, I was able to meet Dr. Crohn. So I finished at NYU in 1984, and as Dr. Jackson mentioned, I moved to the University of Chicago. This is a departmental picture in 1984. It's now 23 years ago, 27, I don't know, I lost count. If you have... the surgeons may remember Dr. Skinner. I'm sorry that the laser, oh, here it is. Dr. Skinner was the chairman of surgery who recruited me in 1984. There's a little joke about that. As a prospective faculty member, I asked the chairman, Dr. Skinner, I said, how long are you planning to be here? Because I want to be in a department where my chair is going to be here for 15, 20, 30 years. And Dr. Skinner, without hesitation, said, don't worry. I've been here only for 12 years. I trained at the MGH and at Hopkins. Both chairs there stayed in place for 30 years. I know exactly what it takes to create the next generation of the next cadre of academic surgeons. And 3 years later, he left. And he left to come to actually a New York hospital, which now is a part of the New York Presbyterian Hospital. Truly is up here, if I can get the laser going. Here it is, with a little more hair and a little darker hair. This was the first year as a faculty member in 1984. The University of Chicago provided me with a great volume of inflammatory bowel disease. During my residency at NYU, probably I'd seen less than 5 cases. And I probably saw 5 cases in the first week I was at the University of Chicago. The University of Chicago was a regional center for inflammatory bowel disease. University of Chicago is down here. Downtown Chicago is here. The medical center is immediately just opposed to the university. Over 20 years, I had the opportunity to operate on close to 1,000 patients with Crohn's disease. And I'm putting here the percentage of location just to give an idea of how Crohn's disease really manifests itself in a surgical practice. And there is no question that the most common location, I wonder whether we could change the battery to this pointer. The most common location is in the terminal ileum, where you can see that 40% of my patients came with disease located in the terminal ileum. The second, thank you very much. Ah, beautiful. This is powerful. The second most common location is really either in the colon and rectum with the probably one out of 5 patients comes with disease in the colon rectum. 1 in 5 patients also comes with complications, septic complications of the anal canal and perineum. And much less common is a disease in the jejunum and proximal ileum with 8% in my experience. Very rare is patients with duodenal disease that require surgical treatment. Probably the most challenging of these patients are the one with multiple sites, the one who have duodenal disease, small bowel disease, or small bowel disease and large bowel disease, or perianal complications and duodenal complications, and so forth. And they really are taxing even to the most expert surgical surgeon. Now, it's always very difficult to talk to a very large audience comprised by medical students and surgeons, residents, physicians, and so forth. Let me address for a second the medical students. If you want to remember something out of this lecture, I think that this slide summarizes the characteristics of Crohn's disease. It's a disease that is pan-intestinal, full thickness across the entire thickness of the bowel, has skip areas, is a recurrent disease, and pathologically is characterized by a non-caseating granuloma. And I'm glad that Dr. Lieberman just walked in so that in case I made a mistake, he can correct me right now. Let me show you some pictures about this. Pan-intestinal. I have had patients with ulcers in the palate, as this slide shows. This is a patient with an upper GI with strictures in the duodenum. This is a very extensive jejunoileitis, represented also as surgeries by this picture here. A barimenema that with reflux in the terminal ileum showing a strictured terminal ileum. This is terminal ileitis with the pictures as surgery. This is Crohn's ileitis, and these are complications, perineal complications of Crohn's disease. So it's a disease that may affect any location of the bowel, from the mouth to the anus, pan-intestinal. It's a disease that grossly is characterized by full thickness disease. This is a loop of terminal ileum. You can see the creeping fat going on the mesenteric fat, creeping all the way on the anti-mesenteric side. If you're an astute observer, you can actually see corkscrew vessels here, which are consistent with serositis. When you open the specimen, you notice that the thickness of the bowel wall is quite remarkable, sometimes going up to 1 centimeter and even more. Most of the thickness is in the submucosa. It is not in the mucosa or in the serosa or the muscularis. It's due to deposition of collagen in the submucosa. If you look at the longitudinal ulcers and the transverse ulcers, they create small islands of mucosa, residual mucosa, giving the impression of cobblestoning. And that's a frequent term that is associated with Crohn's disease. So it's a full thickness disease characterized by cobblestoning. And this is a picture that shows a skip area. This is a terminal ileitis. Then the right column appears grossly normal. Then there is a transverse and descending colitis. This is a skip area, which is typical of Crohn's disease. The other chronic inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, usually does not have skip areas. It's a recurrent disease. This is a case of recurrence at a previous ileocolic anastomosis. This is a picture of a patient with recurrent Crohn's at a previous terminal and ileostomy. And this is a pathologic picture showing a non-caseating granuloma, which is typical of Crohn's disease and is found in about 50% of slides of patients with Crohn's disease. So again, it's a panintestinal, full thickness, skip areas, recurrent, non-caseating granulomas. These are the characteristics of Crohn's disease. I may address the first year or the junior residents. What are the indications for surgical treatment in Crohn's disease? Probably 50% of patients still nowadays come to us for failure of medical treatment. Everything has been done medically, and these patients are still symptomatic. Everything is done medically, and they have developed at this point complications of medical treatment, or the disease progresses with complications while maximal and optimal medical treatment is being delivered. 50% of patients come to surgery because of failure of medical treatment. Probably another 20% come to surgery because of occlusive complications, either obstipation or intestinal obstruction. Let me show you a slide. This is a patient with obstipation, postprandial pain, abdominal cramps due to a severe disease in the small bowel. This is at surgery. Interestingly enough, once the specimen was resected, an enteroenteric fistula was present. Also, we found a fair amount of enteral lesions, which were actually evident on the preoperative abdominal X-ray. And this is the gastrointestinal continuity being reestablished. But please notice how dilated the proximal bowel is from chronic obstipation and chronic bowel obstruction. Another 20% of patients come to surgery because of septic complications. Free perforation is very rare. Inflammatory mass and abscesses are common. And fistulae are very common, but only rarely they are the indication to surgery. And they're only the indication to surgery probably in about 10-15% of patients with a fistula. And their indication to surgery, if the drainage caused by the fistula is a matter of personal embarrassment, such as an enterocutaneous fistula or an enterovaginal fistula, or the fistula communicates with the genital urinary tract, such as an enterocolovesical fistula with recurrent UTIs and deterioration of renal function, or if the fistula produces a functional or anatomical bypass of such degree as to create malabsorption and diarrhea. Let me show you a few pictures. This is a pneumoperitoneum on an upright chest X-ray in a patient in Crohn's disease and a free perforation. Honestly, out of 1,000 patients that I've taken care of, I've only seen 2 cases of free perforations in Crohn's disease, so it's very, very rare. This is an inflammatory mass. You don't need to be an expert radiologist to understand that there is a mass here for which the normal loops have been displaced. This is a cartoon that kind of explain what's happening here. This is a CT scan showing, again, a mass in the right lower quadrant, probably a terminal ileal disease. Inflammatory masses can actually be compressing on the right lower quadrant. This is a patient that had both a hydronephrosis, secondary to compression of this inflammatory mass in the right lower quadrant, as well as a lower extremity DVT on the right side, again due to the compression of this mass. Abscesses are common. This is a patient that came to the emergency room with a huge mass, palpable mass on the right law quadrant at the University of Chicago, where I was, but I can assure you also at Cornell, the first thing we do is to get a CT scan, even if it's obvious that something is wrong here, and probably the patient points there by saying there is an abscess. CT scan was obtained, and it interesting shows an air-free level inside and a disrupted abdominal wall here. And this is one of the two most common locations for abscess is the right lower quadrant. The other most common location is the descending colon in Crohn's disease. Here you see the barium enema and the resected specimen with the perforation here. Fistulas, as I said, are indication to surgery only if they are difficult to manage, such as this enterocutaneous fistula, or they are connected with the genital urinary system, such as this large enterovesical fistula, or if they're a matter of embarrassment, such as this rectovaginal fistula, or in this particular case, a fistula between the duodenum and recurrent disease in the neoterminal ileum, sometimes are indication for surgery. Now, there are other four indications, much less common: hemorrhage, carcinoma, growth retardation in the pediatric population, and fulminant colitis. This is a patient with Crohn's disease who had massive hemorrhage. An angiogram was required to localize exactly which one was the area of Crohn's disease that was bleeding. This is a patient with a carcinoma in the transverse column, and this is a patient with fulminant colitis. Fulminant colitis, carcinomas, and hemorrhages probably represent no more than 8% of indications for surgery. Now, if surgery is needed, what are the possible operations that we can perform? What is the operative strategy in Crohn's disease? And really, there are only four things that we can do for these patients, especially for abdominal Crohn's disease. I'm not talking about perineal Crohn's disease or perineal complications Crohn's disease. Bypass, which nowadays is probably limited to gastroduodenal disease and only some of it. Occasionally, a stoma is all we can do, especially when we're faced with a very large inflammatory mass for which the resection of the inflammatory mass would compromise the patient and probably precipitate the patient into a short gut syndrome. And the two main procedures that we do are either bowel resections or bowel sparing procedures. Bowel sparing procedures are also known as strictoplasties. Now, strictoplasties in Crohn's disease go back about 30 years. And it was Emmanuel Lee, who was working at Radcliffe Infirmary in Oxford, who was the first one to transfer strictoplasties to Crohn's disease. Indeed, it was an Indian surgeon by the name of Kataria who had performed the first strictoplasties on bowel, but it was for tubercular strictures in the terminal ileum. It was Emmanuel Lee who translated that procedure to Crohn's disease. And the first one was done, to my knowledge, at the Radcliffe Infirmary in 1976. And actually, this picture was given to me by Neil Mortensen, who works at the infirmary in Oxford. And it comes from operative sketches that Emmanuel Lee performed in 1976. But it was not until 1982 that he published the first article. And that article, he says, we have delayed reporting it widely in spite of the marked benefit obtained by a group of patients who present one of the most difficult problems of management in clinical medicine. Our particular worry was that the technique contravenes a widely held surgical view, that it is hazardous to anastomose bowel in which Crohn's inflammation is active. And for many, many years and decades, surgeons, rightly so, were absolutely afraid of doing strictoplasties for two reasons. It is against our surgical principles to do surgery in anastomose diseased bowel. Every time there is diseased bowel, we resect it, and we try to resect with abundant margin. And then, considering that this was recurrent disease, it would only make sense that if you leave disease, the recurrence would come back even sooner. And so it took decades of carefully performed studies to demonstrate that although these two concepts seem to make sense, indeed were not what actually happened. And here for you, I've put on this particular slide six studies, each one of them characterized by the fact that it had more than 100 strictoplasties, and each of them had an accurate follow-up. And recently there has been a meta-analysis by Fazio who has proved the same thing. That fortunately, the mortality and morbidity for this procedure is very low. And if you look at the morbidity, mortality is zero in all of these groups, series. The morbidity is reasonable. And if you really look at the morbidity, there's probably about 2-3% GI obstruction, a 2-3% hemorrhage, and a 2-3% dehiscence rate, which is probably not different, not significantly different from the morbidity that you would encounter after a bowel resection. Most importantly, this same six series following patients for a mean follow-up of about 3 to 7.5 years demonstrated that although the recurrence rate for these patients was about 33%, when they went and operated on these patients, the recurrence was mostly away from the strictoplasty site. And it was only in 0 to 8% that there was recurrence on the strictoplasty site. Very important concept. So strictoplasty not only does not predispose to a recurrence, but actually, to a certain extent, there have been data since then demonstrating that the strictoplasty may actually have a protective effect in terms of recurrence of Crohn's disease. Now, for the senior residents, what are the most common strictoplasty techniques? This is the Heineken microstrictoplasty. The nomenclature is taken completely from similar operations performed in the pylorus. In the Heineken microstrictoplasty, which is a good strictoplasty for isolated strictures about 5 centimeters, 6, 7 centimeters long, you can make an enterotomy on the anti-mesenteric side of the bowel and then close it in a transverse direction as to create a diamond-shaped deformity which enlarges the lumen inside. This is an operative case with a mild stricture, longitudinal enterotomy, closed transversally, and creating a diamond-shaped deformity. I like to close it in two layers, but I know that many surgeons also close it effectively in one layer. This is a Finnish strictoplasty. It's a side-to-side strictoplasty where a loop is turned on itself in a U shape and an enterotomy is performed and creating, therefore, a side-to-side non-isoperistaltic strictoplasty and enterostomy. This is a rarely used strictoplasty. It is rarely used because for long strictures, it tends to create a side diverticulum, which it is always worrisome, may retain food and be the site for bacterial overgrowth and potentially in the long-term neoplastic transformation. And this is a Finnish strictoplasty. Usually the Finnish strictoplasty are good strictoplasties for strictures in the order of about 10, 12, 13 centimeters in length. With increasing confidence in strictoplasty techniques, it's very common nowadays to do multiple strictoplasties in the same patient, as these two intraoperative pictures demonstrate. And it is also common to do strictoplasties at different times in the same patient. So the question really is, how do we decide between a bowel-sparing procedure and a resection? And I think really you have to look at where the location of the disease is and what kind of complications. Let's start from the complication that has brought the patient to surgery. As I said before, there are occlusive complications, there are septic complications, hemorrhage, carcinoma, and growth retardation. I can tell you that for carcinoma and hemorrhage, the resection is what you would do. You would never do a strictoplasty for a carcinoma. It's a contraindication. Same thing for a hemorrhage. Septic complications, inflammatory masses, and so forth, I'll show you some pictures. It is not possible to do a strictoplasty. But in occlusive complications, it's a great indication. This is one such patient that, although I personally resected, you know, you can really say that this could have been strictoplastied because you can see a very dilated proximal bowel, a diseased loop of bowel here. This is the specimen. When you open the specimen, the area of disease is probably about 3, 4, 5 centimeters. And so here, probably with some difficulty because of this disparity in the size of the proximal and the distal bowel, a strictoplasty could have been performed. But when you have a walled-off abscess or when you have an inflammatory mass like this, there is no strictoplasty that can be performed. So the complication has a lot to say in terms of choosing between a strictoplasty and a resection. What about the location? Duodenal disease historically has been taken care of with a gastrointestinal bypass, a gastrojejunostomy, but in the last 10, 15 years with, again, increased confidence in performing strictoplasties, we do strictoplasties on the duodenum. This is one such case where a stricture is in the between the second and the third portion of the duodenum. You can recognize reflux in the pancreatic duct here. And this is the same patient in the same orientation at surgery. This is the head of the pancreas. The stricture is here. After performing a longitudinal duodenotomy and after having identified the ampulla to avoid trauma to it, a kind of transverse closure can be performed and a Heineken-Mikulicz strictoplasty can be performed. Disease in the first portion of the duodenum can be addressed with a Heineken-Mikulicz. Disease in the fourth portion of the duodenum or third can be addressed with a Finney strictoplasty. So duodenal disease can be addressed also with strictoplasties. Probably the best place for strictoplasties is the jejunum and ileum. And this is a picture that I showed you before, and this is where most commonly strictoplasty can be performed. The terminal ileum is not a great place to do strictoplasties, and that's because, as you see here, usually it is a thickened disease. The wall of the small bowel is very thickened and unyielding, and usually it's about 8 to 10 inches long. So this is not a great place to do a strictoplasty, and the only strictoplasties that are performed are very complex on this particular side of the intestine. In colon, there have been some authors which have performed strictoplasty in colonic disease. This is a very rare adoption of strictoplasties. There is the only paper that I know that shows the largest experience is by Brering, published in 2001 with some 35 strictoplasties in 29 patients. But if you really look at that, five of them, really, the disease was confined to the ileocecal valve. Nine of them was an anastomotic stricture, probably an ileocolic anastomosis. So there are only 3, 9, and another 8 patients with the pure disease of the colon. And I think that nowadays, I don't believe that it has been demonstrated as yet that strictoplasty is beneficial in Crohn's disease. So let's put it all together. In which patients are bowel-sparing procedures contraindicated? I think that if you have an inflammatory mass, I think you should resect. Or if it's a large inflammatory mass with a lot of bowel adhering to it, maybe a temporary proximal ileostomy is the way to go. Generalized intra-abdominal sepsis for perforation, I think that that's not a good place to do a strictoplasty. You probably wouldn't do a primary anastomosis, so certainly a strictoplasty is even more contraindicated. Long strictures with a thick, unyielding bowel wall, such as a light looks like a garden hose, I think that those are not amenable to a strictoplasty. If you find dysplasia or carcinoma in a stricture, that needs to be resected. And a stricture that is close to an area of resection, I think that for the economy of the entire operation, is better to be addressed with a resection, one resection, rather than a resection and a strictoplasty. Where are they indicated? Well, as I said before, duodenal, jejunal, ileal disease with a single or multiple fibrotic strictures, including recurrences on a previous small bowel anastomosis, I think it's a perfect indication. And strictures on ileocolic colonic anastomosis and selected cases of neoterminal recurrent disease, I think also are good indications for a strictoplasty. Now, the difficulty in Crohn's disease is that usually posed by those 8 to 10% of patients with extensive jejunal ileitis. And this is a case that all of us have encountered. These are strictures indicated by my silks, dilated areas, strictures, another intervening dilated area, strictures, etc., etc. And this can go on for feet, 2, 3, 4, 5 feet. There is no question that the easiest thing to do, and probably the one that is less time-consuming, is to do a bowel resection with a primary anastomosis. Patients will go home in 3, 4 days, but that is not reminiscent or cognizant of the fact that in doing such bowel resection, you also remove and sacrifice a lot of good absorbing mucosa in between strictures. And it's also respectful of the fact that these patients have a recurrent disease, so they will come back for probably more resections later on. And these are the patients that easily are thrown into a small bowel a short gut syndrome. So presented with this problem at the University of Chicago more times than I really care for, in 1993, I performed what I call the side-to-side isoperistaltic strictureplasty. And I published in 1996 because I thought myself that was somewhat of a crazy idea and I wanted to see how it really went. And this technique, and I'll show you some clips just for the surgeons, the bowel is divided, the disease loop is divided halfway. And not only the bowel is divided, but also the mesentery is divided for as much as possible to allow one loop to be moved over the other loop in a side-to-side fashion. And then a very long enteroenterostomy is performed, making sure the strictures on one loop face dilated areas on the other loop, and making sure that, therefore, the two strictures don't face each other. Otherwise, all you're producing are kind of hourglass deformities. Let me show you some of the clips just to give you an idea of how the procedure is done. Again, the loop is divided in half, starting really at the mesentery. Then one loop is moved over the other in a side-to-side fashion, making sure that strictures of one loop don't face strictures of the other loop. Then I usually put a series of stay sutures so that the two loops are well positioned one against the other. Then it's time to do a very long enterotomy. I like to use the cautery. This is a thick bowel. It's bowel that bleeds. Do remember that 2 to 3% of these patients have postoperative hemorrhages. That's why I like to use the electrocautery. This is also the time to inspect the entire two loops. Any areas where you're suspicious for dysplasia or cancer need to be biopsied and a frozen section obtained. And if dysplasia and or cancer is found, the side-to-side isoperistaltic strictureplasty needs to be aborted. When I first started, and this is a movie that goes back to 1996, I used to put a second layer of interrupted sutures because I was very worried about this very long anastomosis. Now I run the internal layer. And then, like you would do in a regular side-to-side anastomosis with a canal stitch, the internal layer of the anastomosis is brought anteriorly and then reinforced with an outside layer of interrupted sutures. In this last pane, you see the final product. I'll start the clip right away, but I want you to look at this area, which is a pseudodiverticulum, which you'll see later on in another clip that I have. This is a side-to-side strictureplasty. You see a tape nearby. This tape is 30 centimeters, and therefore the side-to-side strictureplasty is probably in the order of about 40 centimeters plus 40 centimeters. This allowed us to save 80 centimeters of bowel in this particular patient. I was very worried when I did the first few, and for the first 25 procedures, I follow all of them with enteroclysis. This enterocolitis refers to the patient that I showed you the clips of, and you'll see the pseudodiverticulum, and you'll recognize it. I was worried about the peristalsis, and there you see that through the enterocolitis, you notice that the flow of barium is unimpeded through the entire side-to-side strictoplasty. In those patients where I was able to reach the side-to-side strictoplasty with an endoscope, I also endoscoped them. And here you see the longitudinal anastomosis. And you notice that grossly the disease has quiesced. And actually pathologically through biopsies, we demonstrated that the disease activity quiesces after the strictoplasty. After all, this is a concept that surgeons know, because it's common that when you go back on a patient where you did a strictoplasty years ago, and you go back, most of the times the diseases completely disappear grossly at the site of the old strictoplasties. Recently, I was able to gather several experiences throughout the world, in Italy, in the States, as well as in Japan. Several surgeons have adopted this technique. We're able to collect 186 patients to see whether this technique was reproducible. This 186 patients, as you can imagine, have severe Crohn's disease. 61% were on steroids at the time of surgery, 21% on immunomodulators, and 25% of them on TPN. And interestingly enough, the dehiscence rate in this group was 3.9%, and the hemorrhage rate was 2.1%, very similar to the morbidity encounter with simple strictoplasties. So I think that the side-to-side isoperistaltic strictoplasty is a procedure that is reproducible and certainly can be of use in very extensive jejunal disease. And in terms of long-term results, those patients that we analyzed, the TPN was discontinued in all patients, and only 14 patients out of 186 have had recurrence at the side-to-side strictoplasty site with a follow-up of 5 years. Let me just breach briefly a topic about asymptomatic strictures. Should we do strictoplasties on asymptomatic strictures? I think that, in my opinion, asymptomatic strictures fall in two different categories. The silent stricture beyond a critical stricture. It's silent because proximally there's a stricture so tight that the flow of food does not go through too well. And so a distal stricture, which could be important, is never challenged by enough food, by enough flow, intestinal flow. To me, that is a silent stricture. And then there are non-flow restrictive strictures, which are diagnosed at the time of surgery, potentially because the lumen is not as wide as should be, and maybe is 1.5 centimeter in diameter or 1 centimeter in diameter, and you're kind of worried about those. What should we do? Silent strictures have been recognized. There is a paper in the literature by a group from Wisconsin, from Milwaukee, where they looked at 432 patients operated over 6 years for Crohn's disease, of which 32 required reoperation within 2 years. And if you look at these 32, 11 required reoperations for technical errors. And although they don't specify, the authors don't specify, out of these 11, some required disease required reoperation because disease had not been addressed at the time of the original procedure. So it had been missed. In my opinion, these were silent strictures. They were distal to a dominant strictures, a critical strictures, and they were not recognized by the surgeons. The non-flow restrictive strictures are much more difficult, in my opinion. I personally followed 15 patients with non-flow restrictive strictures, which I did not treat at the time of the original index operation, and 4 of them progressed to symptomatic disease of an average of 48 months, so 4 years, 25% of them. And this has been published in Surgery last year. So 25%, I can say that 25% of non-flow restrictive strictures eventually within 4 years may develop into critical strictures. So what is my strategy for asymptomatic stricture? Well, for the silent strictures, I think that we ought to examine the bowel thoroughly, distal to a critical stricture. by palpation, by putting intraluminal sizers. And if you find a stricture which is severe, I think that needs to be addressed at the time of the surgery. For non-flow restrictive strictures, I have a posture that I perform a prophylactic strictureplasty if the disease appears to be limited in extension and stricturing. And I avoid a prophylactic strictureplasty if the disease appears to be continuous and extensive, allowing at that point for future site declaration with time. And I think that this is, in my opinion, a good strategy, again, to avoid resecting large amounts of bowel. Now, one last slide on the strictureplasties. I need to caution all of you that, indeed, two cases, unfortunately one from me, have been produced to the literature demonstrating the development of an adenocarcinoma at the site of a previous strictureplasty. So I think it behooves all of us to follow these patients with strictureplasties to really understand what is the incidence and the risk of neoplastic transformation. Let me just spend the last 5 minutes on another advance that I believe has taken place in the last 10, 15 years in Crohn's disease. And obviously, you're very cognizant about this, is the laparoscopic approach for Crohn's disease. All of us do it. I think we should do it, a laparoscopic approach, the same way you would do an open approach, which in Crohn's disease means to start the operation by examining the entire bowel. If the disease is confined to the terminal ileum, like this particular case, in my opinion, the easiest way to approach this disease is by first creating a window under the ileocolic vessels, and then taking the ileocolic vessels, and then by using that window, do a dissection which is medial to lateral, all the way to the right parietocolic gutter. Once that is done, the adhesions on the left side of the parietocolic gutter are taken down, and so the entire right colon and terminal ileum are mobilized, and with then a small incision, the specimen can be exteriorized for the anastomosis, which I think it's much easier to do in an extracorporeal fashion. Now, let's take a look at the data available. There is only one prospective randomized study in Crohn's disease for comparing a laparoscopic approach to an open approach. Was done by Jeff Milsom while he was at the Cleveland Clinic before he moved to New York, and Jeff now is a faculty member at Weill Cornell. He included elective surgery, disease confined to the terminal ileum and cecum, an absence of complex fistula and abscesses, and randomized 60 patients to laparoscopic approach versus a conventional approach, and demonstrated that the patients who had a laparoscopic approach recovered 80% of FEV1 and FEVC 2.5 days after the surgery versus 3.5 of the patients after a conventional procedure. And this difference was statistically significant. Although when the pes flatus or a bowel movement and the length of postoperative day were not endpoints of these studies, none of these particular endpoints showed a difference in this particular study. The duration of surgery was longer for the laparoscopic procedure, and the length of the incision makes sense that it was shorter for the laparoscopic approach. Interestingly enough, and against my bias, the laparoscopic procedure patients consume the same amount of postoperative narcotics as the patients with the with an open approach. And so he found no statistically significant difference in those categories. Since then, there have been 15 additional non-randomized studies, two prospective, 13 retrospective. They were summarized by Roseman in 2005. And what this summary shows is that the conversion rate is an average of 7%, between 0 and 29%. Operative time is longer for laparoscopic approach, usually about half an hour. The laparoscopy, on the other hand, the laparoscopic approach significantly reduced the duration of the ileus almost by 1 day, the time to first bowel movement by 3/4 of a day, time to oral intake, time to solid intake, duration of narcotic use, and hospital stay. These were all retrospective. Most of them were retrospective studies. Also, there is a general consensus that the laparoscopic approach is more difficult than the open one, at least for the majority of surgeons nowadays. Offers the benefit of a shorter incision, a longer operative time, probably same immediate postoperative pain, but a faster recovery of GI function and a shorter in-hospital stay. And possibly, there is one paper suggesting that there are fewer episodes of long-term small bowel obstructions. To remind you that these conclusions are based mostly on retrospective studies. 13 out of the 15 were retrospective. And retrospective studies are not the best at reporting complications. And so there is a need for prospective validation of results. But, you know, I think it's fair to say that the laparoscopic approach is here to stay, and it will evolve even further in the next few years. And it is also fair to say that the more difficult cases are still done open. When you have such an inflammatory mass, such as this one, when you have complex fistula, when you have abscesses, when you have a mesentery that is thick, such as this one, 7, 8, 9, 10 centimeters, these are cases that nowadays cannot be addressed laparoscopically with the current technical instrumentation. But it is very possible that this will change with time. So I'd like to thank you for your attention. I'll be delighted to answer your questions. I'll also be delighted to welcome all of you in New York. Many of you have come already and seen us. This is the place in New York City where our hospital is located. This is the New York Presbyterian Hospital at Weill Cornell. This is the East River. This is the old hospital, which opened in 1932. This addition opened in 1996. And tomorrow we'll open an outpatient building on the west side of York Avenue. Here is a magnificent building for outpatient visits and outpatient surgery. So it's with pleasure that we'll be delighted to welcome you and be delighted to show you around. Thank you very much for your attention.